I've fallen totally off.
This meeting of the Health, Housing, Family Security Committee will come to order, and we're going to start with Senator Dibble today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2595. Mr. Chair and members, this is the product of an effort to kind of modernize and update our statutes that relate to the provisions that govern rental property and tenants' rights and landlord rights, and trying to update statutes that haven't really been had any attention or been visited for quite a few years, I think 20 years at a minimum. So a number of things have kind of gotten out of date, a number of things have gone unaddressed for many years, have been fairly ambiguous. And if you recall, at the tail end of a very, very packed hearing a couple of weeks ago, I think there was a package of four bills that had been brought forward that had a whole lot of ideas in them. I carried one of those bills, and a few others carried the other bills. Subsequent to that hearing, the interested parties have gotten together, took a look at all of the ideas that were contained therein, had a fairly robust negotiation, and have come to about 99.9% agreement on what we're presenting here. So, Mr. Chair, I have an A1 delete all amendment. If someone would be so kind as to
Senator Coring offer. Moves the A1 delete everything amendment to Senate File 2595. It's an author's amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to present very quickly kind of the highlights of what's contained in the bill, and Ron Elwood can then present more details or respond to questions. So very quickly, Sections 1 and 2 have to do with expungement motions in instances when there's been a hearing on an eviction. And the short version is that it allows for the expungement motion to be brought at the same hearing in which the eviction case is heard, particularly in those instances when the eviction is declined. That saves everyone, not the least of which Senator Higgins is the court system, the expense and time associated with filing a $300 fee for a new hearing, et cetera. So it's just an efficiency measure that serves all interested parties. Section 3 has to do with late fees.
Is that right?
And what that provides for is to provide some cap on late fees and some provisions around the due date. Section 4 is having to do with an issue around receipt for rent paid, particularly when it's paid in cash, so that there's some documentation of rent that's been paid in case there's some question later on. Section 5, that has to do with the recovery of attorney's fees. Right now, it's specified a number of leases if there's a dispute. And the landlord prevails, then they can also recover attorney fees from the party that did not prevail. And this just creates a kind of a fair playing field so that if, in fact, the tenant prevails, they can also recover attorney's fees. Section 6 has to do with the whole arena of application fees. A number of concerns have cropped up over the years about taking application fees and spending them when someone didn't really have an opportunity to rent, not understanding what exactly the application fee is used for, what the criteria are in judging an application, et cetera. So it simply provides that only one fee essentially would be taken at a time and fully disclose the criteria upon which the application will be judged so someone doesn't pay an application fee if they, again, don't really have a shot. Also, it provide some provisions for those instances when an applicant actually gives false information or omits pertinent information. So there's a remedy there as well. And that's, of course, in the landlord's interest. There's a penalty that's been raised that hasn't been raised for quite a while when security deposits have failed to be returned in bad faith. And that increases from 200 to $500. There is a portion in Section 8, so that was Section 7. Section 8 has to do with this issue of complying with disclosing buildings' utility costs. There has been no remedy for this if in fact the law isn't followed. It's a requirement right now to disclose the liability or the obligation that a tenant is taking on with respect to utilities, but there was no way to really enforce on that. In Section 8, from Section 9 on, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, all
just
bring...
Just through 12.
Oh, I'm sorry, just through 12. Deal with the conformance of federal and state renter protections so that we're up to date with current federal statutes, mostly having to do with those instances when a tenant is in a foreclosed property or a property subject to contract for deed. And we've had a lot of discussion, so I think folks are very familiar with those circumstances when a renter is exposed to potentially losing their housing in those properties that have been foreclosed through no fault of their own. What is 13?
It's actually the part that bifurcated the issue on payment receipt for rent. This is when there's a receipt for money lending.
Oh, so Mr. Chair, yeah, Section 13 again has to do with the. That's right, I read that. Has to do with those instances.
Senator Dibble, if you can move your mouth a little closer to the mic, it's getting
Section 13 relates back to the receipts for rent paid, and this has to do with those instances when rent is paid with money orders versus cash. So, kind of relates back to Section 3. Or, yeah, that, Mr. Chair, is the 30,000 foot overview. Ron Elwood from Legal Services is here to provide further detail or respond to questions.
Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And first, I thank Senator Dibble for carrying one of the bills, and now the bill that contains the agreement between the tenant advocates and the landlord groups. I also would like to thank the chair and Senator Higgins, who carried the other bills, and Senator Kielash, who is not on this committee, but we really appreciate all of your efforts in bringing these issues forward and allowing us to work with the landlords. I'd also like to thank Joan White for taking a very difficult assignment and trying to get this all into shape and our delete all in our agreement. And she did a fantastic job, and I really want to appreciate her work. And finally, I really want to thank the landlords because they operated in extraordinarily good faith with us. There were a lot of issues. There were a lot of stuff that they didn't like. There was stuff that we really wanted. And we actually, in a very expeditious way, came to this framework of a deal. As Senator Dibble pointed out, we do have a couple of T's to cross and I's to dot, but we are going to judiciary from here. So we fully expect to have everything signed, sealed, and delivered. But the content of what you see here is a full agreement between our groups on these concepts. So I'd be happy to stand for questions at this time.
Thank you. Questions from Mr. Elwood. Is there somebody who wished to testify with concerns or somebody who is working on the bill from the other side?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Todd Lelgenquist, Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. And I would just echo the comments previously made. We continue to work on this, and there are a couple things that we still need to work out, but I'm largely pleased with the product so far and happy to be here.
I think people on the committee
Mr.
like
Chairman.
To hear that. Is there further discussion of
Mr.
committee
Chairman.
Members? If not, Senator Corin?
Mr. Chairman, I would so move that Senate File 2595 be recommended to pass as amended on to, judiciary.
On Senator Corin's motion, is there anybody else who had concerns they wanted to speak to in the bill? Any further discussion from committee members? If not, all those in favor of the Corin motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're on your way to one more stop. Thank you for coming. Senator Torres Ray, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would like to call Michael Scandrett, Diane Riddrick, and Vicky Kernett to join me, please. I think they are in the audience. And Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3009. I am very excited to present this to you after having long conversations with different groups who were actually working in their own communities, within their own organizations, doing similar work. And they came to my office and told me about the work they were trying to do, and I figured out that they were moving in the same direction, and that the Department of Human Services, the Department of Health, was really interested in collaborating with the multiple nonprofit organizations that were really trying to figure out a better way to collect data and really begin to talk about how to address some of the disparities issues that we face in the state of Minnesota today. So, and I was also very lucky to find out that the Department of Health, which has been doing significant work in this area, received some funding to do some of this work, and they were very excited about participating in this collaborative effort. So, members and Mr. Chairman, the goal of this legislation is to promote health equity and reduce disparities by increasing the visibility of marginalized communities due to current health data practices. And a large portion of the health data that is collected in the state is categorized but is vague, and it broadly defines terms such as white, Hispanic, and Asian, but it does not accurately capture the diversity within those groups. And so we know now that we are dealing with some issues related to language, for instance, that are significant for the number of African populations that are coming to our state today, and we need to figure out how to address that. And so today with me, I have Mr. Michael Scandrett, who represents a large coalition called the Alliance for Racial and Cultural Health Equity, and the representatives are here in case you would like to know more about the group, and he will describe the legislation, go through the bill. And I also have representatives from the Department of Health and Human Services who do extensive work in this area and who will participate in this process in case you have questions for them.
Senator Torres-Ray, you wanted to work off the A2 amendment?
I am sorry, Mr. Chairman, but actually I was supposed to do that first. Yes, I need to introduce the A2 amendment. We have been working on this language, and actually I have a couple of things that I need to do. I need to introduce the A2 amendment to put the bill in the form that we need for this presentation.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. Next, Mr. Chairman, I need to do a verbal amendment. There is a mistake in one in subdivision 2, 113. This group actually cannot convene because that requires funding. What they are doing is consulting with, and so I need to move the word convene a group and incorporate shall consult with, shall consult. The only word that will be introduced is consult.
So Senator Torres-Ray moves to strike convene a work group and insert consult on line 13. Is there
That's
any
correct,
discussion
Mr.
to that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Consult with, it says, with representatives.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, Mr. Scandrett, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Arche Coalition. And just want to let you know that in approaching the legislation, we are wanting to work very closely with the state agencies, and also the community groups have been very involved too, and we're not trying to move too quickly, but to be sure that some of these changes, the development of the data classifications occurs in coordination with a lot of the new things that are underway in implementing some of the healthcare reforms and the data collection. And I'm not going to go through the amendment in detail, but it basically directs the Departments of Health and Human Services to together develop, first do an inventory of how questions relating to race, ethnicity, culture, socioeconomic status are collected, because there's many, many different ways in which they're collected today, so that we understand that, and then to move to there towards developing a more consolidated way of asking the questions, collecting the data, so that we can really get at where some of the inequities in health status, quality, and access occur. And so the Arche Coalition has come together in the past year or so, and so I'd like to just turn this over to Nancy Pomplin, who will introduce herself and talk a little bit about the coalition and why this is important to the communities.
Thank you, Ms. Pomplin. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Marty and committee. My name is Nancy Pomplin, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Asian American Health Coalition. We are a coalition of Asian and Pacific Islander community members and service organizations here in Minnesota. We are also a part of the Alliance for Racial and Cultural Health Equity, the Leader in This Data campaign. And I personally am a Minnesota resident of 17 years living up in North Minneapolis in Senator Higgins' district. So thank you. It's a great honor for me to be here today testifying in support of a long-awaited bill that will finally mandate the collection of data that is really essential to not only the identity of the Asian and Pacific Islander communities and African and Latino communities here in Minnesota, but also it's a significant step towards systemic change in how we're looking at health today here in Minnesota. Senate File 3009 will standardize the collection and reporting and sharing of race, ethnicity, primary language, and socioeconomic status, as well as country of origin, factors that all impact the health status of an individual and community. This initiative is timely and relevant to the work of the Department of Health, and I'd like to commend Commissioner Sandy Magnin for her vision in really focusing the health disparities initiative of the department towards social determinants of health. We all understand that social determinants of health look at social factors, which include these racial and ethnic categories and socioeconomic status. And it will allow us to begin to truly understand what the root causes and problems are behind health disparities. And it's not just about service access, but it's also about these social factors. I just want to offer an example of what this would mean to our community. Oftentimes, people believe that the Asian and Pacific Islander community is a very homogenous community, and I think living in Minnesota and being here in the Twin Cities, you'll recognize that it's not. However, this aggregating of the Asian community has caused a lot of challenges and resources being equitably distributed to our communities, whether it be the fact that our numbers are small and therefore the disease counts and epidemiologic data does not show much burden of disease, therefore we don't get funded for initiatives like HIV prevention, but then also prevents a real understanding of where the disease is impacting our communities, whether it be the Chinese community, Korean community, or newer Southeast Asian refugee communities. So the collection of more specific ethnicity and primary language data would be very important to our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I, you know, we have representatives from the department, and they are more than happy to speak. I know that you have a long agenda, but they are here also for questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Torres-Ray, and your witnesses. I just want to make sure I understand. You mentioned, Senator, in your opening comments about these categories that we generally have now, white, Asian, so forth, are not necessarily as specific as they could be, and if they were, that there might be some advantage to having data collected on a more specific level. Does that mean, for example, that instead of using the term white, we will be doing things like Irish, German, Norwegian? I mean, is that what we're getting at here, is to try to understand, instead of calling everybody who has light-colored skin white to find out what our ethnic heritage is and then gather data based on that? Is that part of what this would be aimed at doing?
Mr. Chairman, I am going to ask the representatives from the department kind of to define really the intent here and perhaps clarify that the intent here is not to really divide the groups, but really address some of the issues that are affecting minority populations that are small groups, but affected in significant ways. And so we have the disparities that we now deal in health, but they will be, I think, in a better position to respond to your question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm Vicki Quinerth with the Department of Human Services. I represent the state Medicaid agency. I think this is the first step in addressing the issues of disparities that could affect various communities that we work with. And currently at the Department of Human Services, in the general application, we collect the basic racial categories, black, Asian, Hispanic, white. But for new immigrants, we collect a couple dozen language and another couple dozen nation of origin or ethnicities. But I think part of the use of this piece of legislation is to get us started to make sure that data at that level where it's available is available to the local communities and available to clinics where there are issues of health-related sensitivities or things or disparities that need to be addressed. So I'm not necessarily sure at this stage if we would go into some of the detail communities that you described, like Norwegian, Irish. I'm not sure that we would.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ms. Kunerth. But, for example, in my district, we've had a fairly large recent influx of Eastern European from some of the former Soviet republics, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, Moldavian. Is that what we're going to be doing, is gathering data based on country of origin sort of thing, rather than just saying as they would now be considered white or European or something?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that level of detail is to be determined as we work with the communities and go down this path. Because right now, our agency does collect Russian and some of the various Eastern European languages, but we don't go as far down as you just detailed. And the question is, should we do that? Because right now, we only do it for new immigrants. If that Russian adult came to this state and was on our program but had been in this, was a citizen, we wouldn't ask, for example. And so the question is, should we ask that question of everybody in our public programs, or should the health department ask that of everybody in the programs they collect data for? So I guess the answer still is it's to be determined through this process.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I also would like to make clear the census is dealing with a lot of the questions you're asking, but for these purposes, really the direction we're taking is kind of a different one, in a sense that there is a question posed to these departments with respect to a specific issue. So let's say HIV. And in that process, they determine that there is a disproportionate representation of a specific group within that category or that issue, that health issue that they need to address. So the question that will be posed will be, if we have another representation of a specific group, whichever group that may be, do we really know how we can analyze these numbers and who are these individuals, so that we can begin to understand, are we really investing enough dollars, for instance, in prevention, education? Do we have what it takes to address that disparity? So the question does not come from, we have all of these people, they look like this, and we need to break down categories because we will never have enough money to break down ethnic groups. Just in the Asian group, we have, I think it's 37?
30. Mm-hmm.
So we will not try to look at 37, and that's not the intent. The intent is perhaps analyze, what are some of the issues that we face? Where do we have disparities, and how can we begin to understand
who these groups actually are and how do we invest from a policy perspective, how do we invest resources so that we can make a difference. And right now we are not very effective in that process. So I think all of these groups are working kind of in separate ways, and we're trying to bring them together and say, okay, give us some recommendations on how these could be done more effectively. So that's the intent, not to go out and, you know, really break down ethnic groups, because that would be too complicated.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, I was trying to listen intently. So is it, I was confused, and on 1.9 to 1.10, line 1.9, it says country of origin. So is that, I felt like that was addressing Senator Hand's question, but I felt like your answer was, no, we're not going down that path, but the language in the bill says country of origin, and
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, we could. So I want you I hope I'm explaining this correctly, and I'll invite the staff to come in. There are instances in specific areas where you have to dig down into the information about specific groups. And in those instances, you really want to have information, demographic information, all the information you could possibly get to figure out what are some of the characteristics of these groups, what are some of the issues that these groups face. An example, I don't know this is anecdotal, and that's exactly what we want to move away from this anecdotal way of viewing things, is that we hear that a lot of the incidents, HIV, we have a lot of refugees, individuals who are coming from different countries, who are HIV positive. So they come from specific regions, areas where, you know, we have significant problems that we have to address. When they come here, what do we need to do? So country of origin may make a lot of sense in that instance, and we need to know. Now that we're going to know about every country of origin of every patient there is, no. So the exploration will go in a very targeted way. But if you don't have the data, you will never get there. So their intent here is, you will have the information, and the exploration will be done when it is necessary. Explorations on mining data will not happen with everything in all instances, but it has to be available so that if you know, Mayo Clinic is a very important institution that does a lot of collection of data that I'm sure they will be consulting with and doing a lot of work. To better understand these aspects, demographic characteristics of patients that they serve.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Torres-Rae, is there anybody who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I may, then I would like to move Senate File 3009 for to be moved to the floor, I believe. I don't know the staff.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps there was testimony on this already. I don't know. But the Commissioner of Health and Human Services is required to do an inventory and make recommendations. Should I be concerned that there might be a fiscal note associated with this, and does this need to go to finance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a representative of the Department of Health. Actually, this is already being done, and part of what we wanted to do is that all of them work together. But if Mrs. Diane Vaderick could speak about the inventory that is being done, so there is no fiscal note associated.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch. As Senator Torres-Rae noted, there is a data inventory that's already being done within the Health Department that is funded with a federal grant from the Office of Minority Health that the department had received a couple of years ago. So that portion of this bill, that portion would not have a fiscal note because that work is already being done and is being covered by federal funds. As for the recommendations and a report to the legislature, it is possible that there would be a small cost associated with that, depending on the scope of the recommendations and of the report that's required to the legislature.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Rae, your testifier addressed the Department of Health. As I read it, your bill has more specifically to do with the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch,
We have done, the Human Services Department has done part of the inventory, and we can finish the inventory of what we do currently and without additional cost. And I see this as a kind of a first step because, depending on the recommendations, the next step might require additional legislation and maybe costs down the road after the recommendations are out. But in the developing of them, we don't see an additional cost.
Mr. Chair, I'm only hopeful in that as proposals continue to come forward that there's as much latitude given by the department on other reports and recommendations that we are asking for. So often it is the case that we are slapped with additional FTEs. So if this is not the case here, that's wonderful news. I hope that that's a precedent that will follow through going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Lynch. Some of our testifiers are saying that they met. I wish Senator Berglund would be here. They met with Senator Berglund. She knows about the work that is being done and that the recommendations are coming, so she's fully aware that there is no fiscal note associated with this and that the inventory, you guys are taking the lead in the inventory.
Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate File 3009 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there a further discussion of that motion? If not, all
Mr.
those
Chair,
in favor.
Where was it going? You said recommended to pass. The floor.
That's what I'm being told, that the departments are not saying there's going to be a fiscal note. And if there is one, then it comes to problems then in the Finance Committee can request. But that's, I mean, if you want to amend the motion, I'm just saying that that's what I was hearing.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure. No,
I heard it was going to the floor if anybody has problems with that. Amended, but Senator Torres-Ray moved that the bill be recommended pass and sent to the floor. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Yes. I think I saw Senator Sharon in the room.
That's what we did. Well, we did.
Please, no.
Okay. Sorry. There's Barb. I know. We've done two.
Since this morning.
We'll get there. I know. We'll get some. I know.
Welcome to the committee, Senate File 2902, Senator Sharon. And there is an A1 amendment. I assume you want
yes,
that
Yes, that's correct.
Senator Dahl moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Chairman Marty. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you with a bill that attempts to deal with some unintended consequences, I think, that we'd like to avoid, if we possibly can, to families and individuals who are caught in what we hope is a temporary downturn in the economy and layoffs to those people who work in jobs that are the lowest income earners. The A1 amendment that you've just passed is really cleanup language, doesn't change the substance of the bill itself. With the exception of setting a termination date of June 30th, 2012, on what this bill is proposing to do with your support. What it does is indicate that there's an exemption for persons who have lost a job since October 20th of 2008 and have exhausted or are ineligible for benefits under federal state extended unemployment compensation programs or federal emergency unemployment compensation, so persons who are not eligible for unemployment compensation, a readjustment of allowance programs, any other federal unemployment compensation program or benefits under Chapter 268 who meet all other eligibility criteria for general assistance, and they are exempted from meeting the real and personal property limitations under these sections. So what that means when in English is that a person who does not have another resource to go to after being laid off, like unemployment compensation, would typically go to one of the public programs, mental assistance programs, programs that are funded by federal dollars primarily. And if we lift for a period of time the asset limitations, we can allow persons to be on the federally supported programs without having to go deeper and deeper into poverty because they have to sell off their already minimal assets to be eligible for the programs. That is, in essence, what the bill is about. I have with me some persons to speak specifically to the reasons why this is an important bill for you to consider and some of the objectives that we're trying to achieve with the bill. And first, I have with me Marcia Cressy from LIFT, which is a group, Lift to End Poverty. And with that, with your permission, Chairman Marty, I'll have Marcia present.
Ms. Cressy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Marcia Cressy. I live at 1515 Magnolia Avenue East in St. Paul. As Senator Sharon said, I'm a member of Lift to End Poverty. And we're a grassroots organizing drive. We worked a lot with the Legislative Commission to End Poverty 2020 and helped in developing recommendations that would assist our members and assist people in the community to get out of poverty. Many of our members are working poor who are employed in a number of different jobs at the same time. You're in multiple jobs because, you know, one job doesn't pay what you need, or a number of part-time jobs. These jobs often have no benefits, no sick leave, no vacation time. And often we're in a situation where we're not getting paid for the hours that we have to pay for childcare, or the hours that we have to pay for other expenses, because we're in transit from one job to another. And so our expenses are often multiplied because of the multiple jobs that we often have to have in order to make ends meet. That we're moving from one job to the next, you know, doesn't count towards our unemployment. And so when we're without a job, the little that we have is at risk. And what I mean by little is the amount of money that we need to feed our children, to have a place to live. And so not just in the work with the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, but through the other work in the community, we see over and over people that are in a situation where primarily low-paid service workers, people of color, and women who are not eligible for unemployment, working people that are not eligible for unemployment. And a member who came in a few months ago and was pretty much the inspiration for this bill, although it happens a lot, she came in and said that she was off work. She's a PCA. And the woman that she cares for was hospitalized. And again, and it was like, you know, so there, you know, a week, you know, of no work, and a week of no work adds up. Well, the woman was hospitalized and then put in a nursing home for 3 weeks. And our member was not eligible for unemployment because she had a job. She just wasn't working. Because the woman, you know, she was not eligible for NFIB because she has a house that she's been working to have. She has two cars because one of her three children is a teenager who needs a car to help get the other two kids where they need to be. And so she was not eligible because of the assets that she has. She had to turn to friends, you know, and family, and Lyft to get access to have the food that her family needed and to be able to pay her mortgage and such. And this is months ago, and she's still digging out of the debt that was the situation for this three and a half week period. And so, you know, we live so close to the edge that it's really important that we are able to turn to get some help in that short term situation, and that so these asset tests don't serve to move us out of poverty, but merely inadvertently serve to dig us in deeper. And state aid, you know, shouldn't function to make people poorer. And that's why we need your support for this bill today.
Thank you, Ms. Cressy.
Excuse me.
Senator Sherman, you go ahead with your witnesses.
Thank you. I just want to highlight, you know, the central message is that we are talking about people that are clearly on the edge anyway, and that our public programs don't serve in their current structure to help keep people out of poverty. They inadvertently, by policies, may drive people further into poverty, and that's what this policy is
about. And I think that's true. Ms. Cressy, she mentioned that they worked with the Poverty Commission. One of the things we kept seeing was how our programs trap people in poverty. They don't let them build assets and have a chance to get out.
And our next presenter, Senator Marty, who will speak more to this issue and recognizing that the Poverty Commission has recognized this problem and that a long-term solution needs to be discussed. What we're talking about here is a temporary solution given the downturn in the economy. And so with me from Affirmative Options Coalition is Deborah Schlick, who would like to make a few comments regarding the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and committee members. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're nonprofit agencies that advocate for effective policy to end poverty. And I'm here to offer information that I think supports the bill that Senator Sharon and Lift End Poverty have brought forward. We had asked for some data analysis from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Minnesota Department of Human Services. The analysis they did for us showed that of 96,000 parents who enrolled on cash assistance in Minnesota in three different years, half are coming straight from jobs. They have quarters, that in the same quarter in which they've made an application for assistance, they show earnings and hours of work. And we think they are a portion of the 50% of Minnesotans who are unemployed and unable to collect unemployment insurance. And the workers who turn to the Minnesota Family Investment Program come primarily out of four labor industries. They come out of hotel restaurant work, they come out of retail work, they come out of temp agencies, and like the example Ms. Cressy offered, they come out of the healthcare industry. And what we think this data shows is that there's a misfit between an unemployment insurance program we designed a couple generations ago and what's happened in corners of the labor market where there's a lot of part-time work, there's a lot of very short-term work, there's a lot of low-wage work, and there's a lot of work of hours that expand and contract very quickly from week to week or day to day that structurally don't fit the unemployment insurance program. And what we appreciate about the bill that's being introduced is that were these workers able to turn to unemployment insurance, they would not face an asset test. And so what this does is make consistent for different groups of workers similar standards for help during periods of unemployment.
Thank you, Ms. Schlick.
Thank you, Senator Marty. The next person to speak with you is from the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and will speak further to the bill, Alexandra Fitzsimmons.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The MCC is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church throughout Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of Senator Sharon's bill, Senate File 2092. Asset limits are inconsistent with Minnesota's emphasis on work and self-reliance and punish the very families that are trying to maintain or achieve economic independence by building their savings. Forcing individuals to spend down long-term savings to qualify for short-term assistance leaves individuals and families more vulnerable in the future. By reforming the asset limit for MFIP and GA under the specific circumstances that are outlined in this bill, Minnesota can take a significant step towards encouraging and allowing our neighbors to save and build for the future. As you know, assets are limited to $2,000 for MFIP applicants and $5,000 for ongoing MFIP recipients. The current asset limit for GA is $1,500. This amount oftentimes represents needed funds to pay rent, a mortgage payment, health care costs, or other pressing needs. In its final report, the Legislative Commission to End Poverty in Minnesota by 2020 identified six broad challenges to ending poverty in our state. One of the challenges addressed this very issue. According to the Commission's report, public assistance programs must work to move people toward financial self-sufficiency. Too often, well-intentioned programs end up having the opposite effect, especially when they lead to asset depletion as a condition for participation. The Commission also identified the need for helping Minnesotans build and maintain financial assets. To these ends, the Commission recommended enacting public policies that encourage maintenance of assets. In order to end poverty, individuals and communities must have the opportunity to build wealth. As the Commission eloquently but simply stated, income is how we get by, assets are how we get ahead. As such, I encourage this committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Marty, I would just like to draw attention to the bill. I failed to say this in the review of the bill, that there's two sections that have the same language in it, and I just want the committee to know that we're addressing both GA, General Assistance, and MFIP as sources of our program finance sources that would be available. And I want to draw special attention to line 1.9, where it says persons who are ineligible for benefits under the federal state extended unemployment compensation program. What's important about that and the rest of the language is that the persons we're talking about are persons who are not people who lose their job, who have had, you know, substantive jobs that are eligible for unemployment because they've been employed full time. These are persons who would therefore start not spending down assets appropriately. This is for persons who are on very part-time jobs, multiple jobs, to try to capture enough revenue, and it's a time-limited program to help support them until the economy sort of turns around and gives us time to take a look at this issue over a longer-term basis.
Maybe one of the witnesses could tell me, if I work in a hospital or a restaurant type of thing where I have variable hours, and one week I may work 10 hours, next one 25 hours. If I do qualify for unemployment compensation, first of all, would I in such a situation like that, or might I? And if so, how is the hours of that calculated, how much I'm eligible for? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, the data analysis that DEED was able to do was not able to pull out specific worker situations, so we're beginning analysis at that. But what we think the data indicates is that to qualify for unemployment insurance, you have to have enough earnings, you have to have enough quarters of work, and you have to have left the job for an appropriate reason. So if you've been at that restaurant for a quarter and a half, and you have some weeks where you have very low earnings and another week where you maybe have actually worked a full week, and in that process they've asked you now to move to an evening shift and you don't have daycare to cover that evening shift, you won't meet any of the tests for unemployment insurance. So we think it's a very basic structural piece about how unemployment insurance is structured and how these jobs function.
Because of the fact that you were not laid off, you were just transferred to hours that you couldn't work.
Right. So it looks to the system as though you had voluntarily left that job. Had you been in the job long enough, the inability to secure child care would have qualified you for unemployment insurance. But since neither your earnings nor your quarters do, and the reason doesn't, it becomes a constellation.
And then the question about, and I think this may be for Senator Berglund, the asset test on food stamps. There was an article in the business section this week and so on. Senator Berglund, did you have a bill that was going to deal with the asset, remove the asset limit for food stamps? Is that in your division?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so we don't need to see that. That's fine. I just want to make sure because this is our last meeting before deadline. So,
I believe it's in my division, okay. And we've raised it in the past. So, I mean, it really isn't a policy issue. It's just
right. I don't have any problem. I mean, I think that the loss of federal money from that is
we don't believe the bill costs any money because food stamps are paid for by the federal government. So,
good. I'm glad you have. I just was curious to make sure because I had thinking that this bill was including that, but it was not. So is there further discussion about the bill? Any questions from the committee? Is there anybody in the audience wish to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there a motion? Senator Pretner-Solon moves that Senate file 2092 as amended, 2902 as amended be recommended pass, and this one does go to finance, I assume. I had a question about your amendment. Put it as a two-year thing. That's because, I mean, you were talking about it as a two-year thing so we can revisit how we look at unemployment compensation and everything. So that was the reason you originally the bill was introduced. It was an ongoing change.
Senator Marty, yes, I thought that that if there would be concerns about this, that this would give us time to see what's happening and take a look at it, and we can always extend that time if we find that it's achieves the objectives that we believe that it will achieve in terms of keeping people out of poverty and the costs that are associated with that.
On Senator Pretner-Solon's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. My bill. I'm next. Senator Berglund, you want to do your issues?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Senator Berglund, Senate File 2552.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2552 is a bill that would help us possibly save some money in our budget by moving some of our group residential housing beds into waiver slots. There are a lot of people in the group residential housing beds that are Medicaid eligible and would meet the criteria for receiving a waiver slot, but we don't have them in a waiver slot. So this bill does a number of things to help facilitate that. First of all, the Department of Human Services has reinterpreted the federal waiver policy to limit the number of persons under age of 55 on a CADI or TBI waiver to no more than four people under a roof, regardless of the size of the roof. This policy is being applied to apartment buildings in which Assisted Living Plus or Customized Living Services are provided. So this legislation would ask that they not reinterpret that policy without input of the legislature and without clearer direction from the federal government. Then the bill would further go on to allow the growth of waiver beds to accommodate new transference of group residential housing beds to the waiver program. The waiver brings in federal Medicaid dollars. Group residential housing does not have any federal dollars in it. And there are quite a number of exciting
projects out there in the pipeline to provide not one-size-fits-all type of apartment housing, but many different levels of care for people with waivered services within an apartment complex. And so with that, we can hear from Mr. Hastings and then take questions and have any other testimony.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Hastings, and I'm with the Association of Supported Living Residences. And with me is Mrs. Victoria Fram, who operates several settings that serve people with younger people with disabilities, notably people with mental illness. In the last couple of years, they developed a new apartment site in northeast Minneapolis, serving people on a waiver program in their own apartments with assisted living plus services, and wanted to respond to a new solicitation of interest from Hennepin County to develop an additional site at the request of the community. And at that time, there
can you move the microphone a little bit closer? It's a little
sorry.
Bit noisy. I'm sorry.
At that time, there seemed to be some confusion or lack of clarity in what the policy was from the Department of Human Services as to whether these developments could go ahead. The result was that the solicitation of interest was pulled from the county, and any further development of this sort is in limbo land. And at the same time, the policy is now that you cannot deliver waiver services in any setting of more than four, which puts us in the position where we're paying for a lot of services for eligible individuals out of 100% state dollars through the group residential housing program. They could possibly be shifted to home and community-based waiver programs and obtain a federal match.
Mr. Chairman, I did forget that I do have an amendment for this bill.
Senator Berglund,
I have an A2 amendment, I think, up there.
A2 amendment. Is it in the package?
Nobody has it?
No. We will find it.
All right.
A2 amendment to the bill. Anyway, while they're looking for the amendment, any questions from the committee? So basically, it's going to be different funding. We'll get federal funding for it if we.
Well, Mr. Chair.
That's a bill Senator Lori has up tonight.
Do you need an amendment, or is it?
Nope, different bill. Sorry.
Okay. Good reason they don't have one then. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 2552 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Sullivan.
I have just a question about the criteria for the individuals that are eligible for the waivered services and the GHS, group housing, GRH. Mm-hmm. Are they the same individuals? Or do they need to meet different criteria, or do they meet different criteria?
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Hastings.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the answer to that question is no, the requirements are different for group residential housing. You just have to meet an asset and income requirement and be placed there by a social worker, case aid, employed by the county of financial responsibility. To be eligible for a waiver, you have to be, first of all, eligible for Medicaid. You have to be disabled as determined by Social Security Administration. You have to be under the age of 65 at the time of application for the CADI waiver or have a traumatic or acquired brain injury for the TBI waiver. And you have to require at least one waiver services. So there is quite a difference between the eligibility requirements between the two populations.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I can just add, we wouldn't be able to convert all of our GRH beds. But there's a considerable number of them that we could convert. And
okay.
So I'm not saying we would no longer have GRH housing, but maybe we can save a few nickels here in providing the type of housing and services that some of the individuals need.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, is that something that could revert back and forth, or is it something that would have to be permanently converted, that those they be waivered slots that are permanently determined as such, or?
Well, I mean, I suppose there'd be some small ebb and flow as people maybe would be, as people die and new people fill the places. But, I mean, basically we're talking about generally a permanent increase to accommodate this group of people.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 2552 be recommended passed and referred to Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Chair, I have Senate file, 2139 we'll do first, I guess, the orthotic and prosthetic devices health insurance coverage amendment. And we do have, and this bill has been to another committee. We've been working with the two sides, and we actually have a delete everything amendment, which doesn't change a lot, but I will, and we have, it was largely clarifying language and so on. And so I will move the delete everything A4 amendment, but before we vote on it, because it's been through another committee, I will suggest, I asked Senate Counsel if we had some way of showing it, and she showed me the notes and what she was changing, because most of it was clarifying it and better choice of language. So I think I'm going to ask that her notes be handed out so people can see the nature of the changes. We also have people here who are on both sides of it who can, I think, tell you if they feel there were where the substantive changes were and so on. But, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that would require equivalent health insurance coverage for orthotic and prosthetic devices. We have concerns that health plans have been excluding certain types of things that I think most of us assumed were covered. It's not a large population that needs these devices, but they're very expensive, and they need them. They are not permanent. They are things that need to be replaced from time to time. And I have some witnesses to speak to it, but the bottom line is what the bill would do would be to require that it's on Subdivision 2, the health plan has to provide coverage for orthotic and prosthetic devices and supplies to the extent that Medicare covers them, and it can be, its coverage is limited to the most appropriate model determined medically necessary, and all the expenses related to that are there. At the top of, I'm working off the delete everything, which is, again, as I said, similar in content but slightly different wording. The A4 amendment at the top of page 3, you can see that can be subject only to the annual lifetime dollar maximum that applies to all the general terms and services under the health plan. Reimbursement must be equivalent to reimbursement for other similar types of medical services. And coverage for devices cannot have pre-existing conditions placed on it, limitations for pre-existing conditions on it. And it must include complex and emerging technologies. That's the gist of the bill, and I have several witnesses who wish to speak to it and then be glad to take questions.
So, Senator Marty, you want to let us digest this before you offer
sure.
the amendment
well, maybe,
and
maybe
hear
what
from
I'll
the
do
speakers?
Is say, maybe Senate Counsel, maybe you could characterize the changes in it, there, if there were substantive changes in it.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I don't believe there were any really major substantive changes. There were, looked like there was just tightening up the language.
And I think that was the health plans had some
Senator
concerns
Marty.
About it, and when two sides met, they came up with slightly different language, but I don't think it's substantively different. So I will move the A4 amendment, and if members of the committee want have questions about that, I'm not trying to pull any fast ones or anything. We're just trying to get the language cleaned up.
So Senator Marty moves the A4 amendment. Are there any discussions or any questions on Senator Marty's motion to move the A4 amendment? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And you'd like to hear from your speakers?
If we could go ahead.
Well, thank you, Senator Marty, and Madam Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for this hearing today. I'm Richard Miller from Rochester, Minnesota. I am a certified orthotist and president of the Minnesota Society of Orthotists, Prosthetists, and Podorthists. We shorten that to MSOP for obvious reasons. We're here to discuss today the merits of proposed legislation that involves insurance coverage for orthotic and prosthetic services and devices. Like so many other legislative actions these days, it all boils down to a debate on who pays for what. Ultimately, we feel that coverage for orthotics and prosthetics is the responsibility of insurers to include in shared risk plans and not left to be considered as out-of-pocket expenses or deferred to public assistance programs. My concern today is a proposed change by the insurance representatives to omit coverage for orthotic devices and services from this bill. As I stated, I'm a certified orthotist with over 35 years of experience in the field in Minnesota, by the way. There's a common misconception with the word regarding the word orthotics, and generally thinking that the term only refers to arch supports for the foot. I'm here today just to have some brief comments to clarify what we mean and illuminate what we call orthotics using real examples of the needs of people and how those needs are met by orthotic technology. Most everybody is aware that a prosthetic device or a prosthetic limb is an artificial limb replacing a missing body part, but there is some confusion and misconception regarding orthotics. So just indulge me for another minute or so. I'll give you some of these examples. A baby is born with a condition of spina bifida, requiring surgery for many issues, but still left with the inability to develop skills for independent walking due to lower extremity paralysis. Physicians prescribe orthoses to give the leg stability that the legs cannot provide for themselves. Obviously, there is a lifetime need for orthotic care, as this condition will not improve with time. A teenage boy is injured in a shallow water diving accident at a friend's cabin in northern Minnesota. His cervical spine is fractured, resulting in spinal cord injury and quadriplegia, which is permanent paralysis of his legs and a dramatic loss of his arms and hands. Following the surgery to stabilize his neck, he may actually require a halo device, which is an orthosis, followed by a cervical brace, which again is an orthotic device, to immobilize it further after surgery. When this patient gets in the rehabilitative phase, we can actually return some function to his hands and fingers independently through harnessing motion remaining in the wrist to provide a grasp and release function so the patient can continue with activities of daily living, feeding, self-care, including self-catheterization. A 50-year-old man is cleaning his gutters and falls from a ladder. The resulting burst fracture or compression fracture requires the use of a body jacket, or what we call a thoracolumbosacral orthosis, which we obviously shorten to TLSO, and that's to stabilize and allow for safe and early ambulation and mobility. A single mother of three suffers a stroke and requires extensive rehab. She cannot ambulate independently and safely without some stability added to her ankle. Her physician prescribes an orthotic device, an AFO, or ankle-foot orthosis, prescribed to help her to ambulate safely, independently, to care for her children, and to return to work. These examples are generic, but they do represent the impact that orthotic devices have every day in the state of Minnesota to help return people who've suffered injury, disease, or a birth anomaly to active, productive lives. This bill before you is important to provide coverage for prosthetic limbs to amputees, but please don't allow us to negotiate away the important coverage of orthotic devices and services. To leave orthotic coverage out is to leave the door open for carve-outs and coverage caps. This can only result in increased out-of-pocket expense or reliance on public assistance, or worse, denial of treatment and increasing disability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Are there any questions or comments? And the next speaker is
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Aaron Holm. I'm from Shakopee, Minnesota, where I reside with my wife and three kids. On January 2nd, 2007, while assisting a coworker change a flat tire on the side of 394 in Wayzata, I was struck from behind by an unattended driver. As a result of the impact, I lost both of my legs above the knees. The next several months included a lot of recovery and rehabilitation, modifications to the home, basically becoming accustomed to my new way of life. After about 5 months, I was fitted for prosthetics. After 6 months, I was walking again. 7 months, I returned to work, started playing golf and traveling. I was rehabbed pretty quick. The word got out of my recovery in the amputee community, and we started receiving a lot of phone calls and emails from individuals that had heard my story and were inquiring on how we did certain things, who our physical therapist was, the type of prosthetics we got, where we went for prosthetics, etc. With that, I decided to resign from my full-time job and form an organization called Wiggle Your Toes, which is designed to give back to the amputee community and help them in their recovery and rehabilitation efforts. A common theme after forming this organization and communicating with the amputee community was, well, first of all, the common question was, how did you get your prosthetics approved? And not until I heard that several times did I realize that because my case was classified as a workman's compensation case, I was given the tools that I needed. I never had to look back. I recovered quickly. I was fitted. I was given the tools, the medical devices that we requested, and I was successful. Within 9 months, I played 25 rounds of golf all over the nation. That's why I'm here today. I'm here to represent the amputee community, to talk about some of the individuals that we've worked with over the last year and a half since we were formed, and I guess to be an example of what can be accomplished if the right tools were granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holm. Are there any questions or comments for the speaker? Thank you. The next speaker is Terry Kufo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Terry Kufo, and I work with MSOP, the acronym that Rick so graciously gave to the Minnesota Society of Orthotists, Prosthetists, and Pedorthists. We are a group comprised of individuals in the field, owners, practitioners, students, parents, patient advocates, patients themselves. And what I would like to share today is that the caps, the carve-outs, the restrictions that we are seeing are specific. Either we are finding the elimination of orthotics and prosthetics altogether, one or the other. We are seeing annual caps in prosthetics of $1,000, $2,500, $10,000. We are seeing limits to one prosthetic device per life. We are seeing denials of specific devices that have been prescribed by physicians when coverage and medical necessity is in place. On the orthotics and the custom bracing side, we are also seeing annual caps of $250, $500 per year. We are seeing limits to one orthotic device every 3 years. We are also seeing denials that are specific, where specific devices are prescribed by physicians, coverage is in place, medical necessity is in place, yet the devices are denied. We have an arsenal filled with patient examples. Aaron has spoken for some, and I don't want to take too much more of your time. So if there are any questions.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Kufel?
Yes, Kufel.
Thank you. You mentioned in your testimony that the number of restrictions and carve-outs and limitations that are currently in place in insurance coverage. Why, in your view, are those restrictions and in place. What's the rationale for that?
Ms. Coffel.
In my opinion, it is based on cost.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Coffel, that would be my assumption. I've gotten some information that says that, in effect, that those costs are minimal. And this is what I'm struggling with, this, and I'm referring to members of this page. I don't know who it came from exactly, but it talks about the need, and it mentions some statistics at the top that says about 27% of the population would be affected by the bill, which I take it to mean that there would be about a third of the population that would be eligible for things under this bill that maybe currently would not be. And then the cost says it's about, the maximum would be maybe $3 a year.
It's very minimal.
And so that, Madam Chair and Ms. Coffel, if it's so minimal, why would insurance companies not be willing to do this? It seems to me that if that's all true, that if on the one hand, I'm kind of struck by, well, if there's a huge number of people, one-third of the population, that will suddenly be eligible for benefits that they aren't right now, hard to believe that's going to be a minimal cost. But if the argument is it's a minimal cost, why wouldn't insurance companies today want to extend that coverage to those things?
I don't know if you can expand on that, Ms. Hahn. It may be the insurance company should respond. Senator Marty.
Hey, Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, part of the issue becomes who ends up paying some of the, when you look at the costs and they're talking about some of the savings and so on, if Mr. Holm needs some prosthetics and doesn't get them or gets the wrong ones, the ones that apparently I don't understand this enough, but some types of legs are you're more likely to trip with and so on, and if you fall down and you're an older person with more frail bones, and so you may have all kinds of other complications, but then you're no longer in the health plan, then you're going to be losing your job, you're going to be on public program. We actually have a request for a fiscal note in and expect it's going to save money to the state because with the limb, which is the obligation of the health plan under this legislation, which most of them are covering and they claim they are covering, but if the plan is covering the artificial limb, you have a lot of prevented other costs that may not be the responsible of the health plan. They may be the public program because the person can't work anymore, loses their job, and so on. So I think the issue is, yes, it may cost the health plan more, but without this, it costs society and public programs more.
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I understand that. I'm not sure that the costs go away. It seems like what you're suggesting is that either the people who pay for insurance privately will bear a larger cost or the public will bear a larger cost, one way or the other. I'm not sure those costs go away, just a question of who's going to pay them. But what doesn't seem to me to make sense is that the insurance companies would provide for one-third of the population for benefits that are not currently being covered as the bill would ask them to be covered, and yet the cost of the insurance companies would be very minimal. That, to me, doesn't make sense. It seems like it could be very feasible to say, all right, if you're going to mandate insurance companies cover these things, that then there will be a substantial cost to do that. But the bill itself says that you can't raise those premiums to compensate for those additional costs. And that's what I'm struggling with, is that if we're going to have those costs covered, then we ought to pay for them one way or the other. But it's unclear exactly that would happen under this bill.
Excuse me, Madam Chair and Senator. I just briefly wanted to introduce myself. I'm Greta Nelson, and I'm actually the parent of a young man who's a bilateral amputee, and just thought maybe I could speak to you, Senator Hahn, just quickly regarding that question. And I think basically what I would say to that, to understand that, obviously we want to be very transparent that there is a small cost required to cover these types of devices and things like that. But I would say, in my experience dealing with the health plans, they look at us as a very small little group.
And there are very few people that need these types of devices in the grand scheme of things. So when a health plan is looking at their cost savings, I'm sure it's very easy for them to say, well, this is such a small little group of people. If we just cut out this coverage, if we carve out our responsibility for this kind of device, they're a small enough group that it really won't affect that many people, and we can, you know, recoup costs by moving those costs on to a state plan or making people take full responsibility for reimbursement all on their own.
And Madam Chair, and maybe there is somebody from the insurance side that would like to talk about this. I'm not. The logic of this is escaping me, because on the one hand there was testimony that these devices can be very, very expensive, and then we have this sheet that says that 27% of the population would be eligible for benefits, and then the claim is that the actual increase in cost to insurance is very, very low, and that doesn't make sense if you add all those things up. And so I need to have somebody from the insurance side explain how that works, or where exactly are the costs going to end up? Because I understand that this is an expensive thing. It's not a lot of people, but nevertheless very expensive, and the costs are going to be paid somewhere. I just want to be clear on where they're going to be paid.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, a couple of comments. One, first of all, most of the health plans are covering, and it's the trouble is we're seeing cutbacks and all of a sudden limitations on things that, I mean, these limbs, her son, I believe, needs new limbs every couple of years or so, and covering somebody for one a year is not that much. As you see on that fact sheet that I think is in the packet, the cost of premium increase could be from 12 to 25 cents per member per month. The point is it's such a small percentage of the population that does it. It is spread out over that. It's not a big factor in the cost. It's a very real factor. When we're talking about costs, I think one point I'd like to make is that it's a lot more cost-effective to have somebody have the limbs, the devices they need in order to participate fully in society, because that's a lot cheaper than the problems. And if you don't have it and have all these other expenses, that costs a lot more. It's different people paying, but it's a lot more. Okay, we have somebody from the chamber I know wanted to speak with.
Yes, Senator Marty. And at this time, I'll call on Cecilia Rattel. Or maybe not. Okay. And Mr. Bartsch?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if it's okay, I'll go first. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch. I represent Health Partners. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We're here today to express our opposition to the bill as it is before you. I do want to acknowledge and thank the proponents for taking the time to sit down with me on Monday to walk through what our major concerns were with the legislation, and the A4 amendment that we had forward today addresses some of those concerns, but not some of the fundamental concerns, which I'll talk about in a second. As was stated before, the members of the Council of Health Plans, we do cover prosthetics and orthotics. In fact, we also provide coverage for some of the newer prosthetics and orthotics that were talked about today. The issue and the biggest issue we have before us is not applying or asking us to cover things that we don't. It's the changes in the law that really give sole ability to determine what is medically necessary and therefore what is ultimately paid for to the prescribing provider. And I've got the A4 amendment, and I'll reference some of the language. But particularly if you go to line 2.29 through the rest of that page, it talks about the services that are most appropriate model determined medically necessary by the prescribing physician or licensed healthcare prescriber. And our concern with that is essentially it removes any ability of the health plan to determine what should and shouldn't be paid for based on efficacy, quality, or anything else. People may not like the fact that part of the role of the health plan is to help determine medical necessity, but that is our role in the system. And as someone once told me, whether we like it or not, someone has to manage health care. Our concern is that by giving this broad exception, you're really creating a situation where anything, anytime, any place is covered so long as a prescribing physician determines it's medically necessary in their own minds. Now, I would argue, and I'm sure the proponents would agree, that most of the physicians or providers in this community wouldn't take exception to that. It does create the opportunity for some, too. That's where the grave concern for us in terms of cost increases lie. So when you look at the 12% to 25% estimate of cost increase that we've seen in the other handout, I think that's an estimate that was based on what the other state laws have been. Our concern is that we're not applying the coverage standards that may be in those other states to what we do in Minnesota, but we're going much beyond that and allowing for the coverage of a broader array of devices than we may currently cover or many more devices than we currently cover. And I would suggest that the language also talking about complex and emerging technologies is a similar situation. I understand the need by the proponents to make exceptions in terms of where Medicare in particular may not have new codes to rely on new prosthetics and orthotics, but it was discussed in our meeting the other day. You know, in those instances when they occur today, as with existing occurrences on coverage of prosthetics or orthotics, they work with the health plans in this community to make coverage determinations, and we think that process is actually working well. If there are plans or policies that are putting specific limitations or removing coverage of prosthetics or orthotics, we want to know who those companies are so we can help get a better handle on the issue. You know, are these issues where we have self-insured employers who are eliminating coverage broadly or making these types of limitations on annual maximums? That's not our policy, so we want to address that as well. But that remains our largest concern, is that this is unique and that it's giving that broad exception to the prescribing provider. I'd also like to point out a couple other issues we have with the bill. That is on line 3.7 to 3.8, we're making an exception for this coverage not to be an allowance as, or a pre-existing condition. Again, we don't make that determination in law for specific instances. This would be an exception there. And the last thing I'd like to point out is one of the suggestions we had was to make sure that this coverage, while it's drafted to 62A, we also apply this standard to our state public programs. We've had this discussion in this committee before, but we certainly want to make sure that if we are providing for coverage in our commercial marketplace, we want to make sure that the people in our state public programs have access to that same level of coverage. As we lead, the language is drafted to 62A. I think there's some ambiguity if that does apply to 256B or the products under that. We'd like to clarify that this does apply to Medicaid and Minnesota care. And I guess we can't say general assistance medical care. We'll find out when we see the bill language on that issue if we can or not. But that would be an additional concern of ours.
Questions? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the language that is in the amendment, have you or anybody in your association looked at what the increase in premiums would be? You're sort of challenging the 12 to 25 cent per month number. So if all the things in the bill as it is today were to be passed into law, what would the increase in premiums look like? Do you have any idea what that is?
Mr. Barsh.
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, we haven't run those numbers as a percentage of premium yet. We certainly know that there are instances where we are getting requests for coverage of devices, often for recreation or other purposes, that would, if the prescribing provider determined them medically necessary, have to be covered now. And as we talked about, some of these specific devices are very expensive. So we haven't run the numbers, but I believe, you know, this process and this bill will have to go through a fiscal noting process for the State Employee Group Insurance Plan, and we'll be, you know, as they have their consultants work with those numbers, they'll have to work with us and figure out what those assumptions might be.
Right. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barsh, you mentioned this relationship, I mean, with health management, and I understand that the need for managing the system, but the doctor's job is to determine what is medically necessary, not the HMOs or the insurance companies. From my point of view, their job is to determine what, you know, cost containment. And, you know, so the way I read this language, it's just that to determine what is medically necessary, which is their job, and that there's another, provision in there about prior authorization on Subdivision 3 that allows that you could require that there be prior authorization. Doesn't that solve the issue about having, you know, the ability to be a part of this conversation and determining what is appropriate overall for this particular patient?
Mr. Barsh.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, that's a great question, and I look at the language providing the ability to do prior authorization as an attempt to do that. However, as we read the language, health plans use prior authorization to determine medical necessity, which is a term we use based on the insurance coverage policy you buy. And so if you're not allowing us to have any say in terms of medical necessity, we really have nothing to prior authorize. I mean, we could still do it, but, you know, we'd just be being big pains, and we get criticized for doing that enough. So I recognize the intent of that, but if the medical necessity determination is solely with the provider, we really have nothing to prior authorize.
Mr. Barsh, is there not a standard criteria for medical necessity, and either it applies or it doesn't apply?
Madam Chair, actually that's a great point, and that's one of the areas where I appreciate the proponents looking at the language we suggested, which is applying a standard basically to Medicare. So Medicare does have rules and guidelines in terms of what they use to determine medical necessity, and it's the current practice usually with prescribing providers and the health plans to use that same criteria when they're making those determinations. So it refers to the Medicare guidelines, but then it later goes on to say, as solely determined by the prescribing physician. So there again, we don't have the ability to use those guidelines.
Other questions or comments?
If I may. Thank you. I don't believe it says solely. First and foremost, we're looking at the bill together here. I believe the language is determined medically necessary by the prescribing
What line are you
physician.
On, please?
We are looking at
2.29.
And if I may, currently there are standards set in place, accepted standards put in place where the physicians, the patients, the prosthetist, the orthotist, and also the insurance carriers come together and they determine medical necessity. Medical necessity is not an arbitrary thing. We look at age, height, weight, the activity levels of the individuals. We look at their employment. We look at their recreational activity. We look at their family life. And together we determine what the most appropriate device is for the individual. The problem we are seeing is that when we determine this, and it is appropriate, and we have coverage. Sometimes we have coverage, sometimes we don't. We have a prescribing physician. We still have denials. We are following Medicare guidelines. That is the standard. And we spoke with Jeff earlier in the week and agreed that Medicare is the guideline that we follow. That language has been revised to be more clear. Please, if you will, the Medicare guidelines do not allow for, the HCFA coding schedule does not allow for what Jeff has termed as recreational legs. So if we are following Medicare guidelines, his concern for recreational legs and above and beyond what is necessary, these are not concerns that we see.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment on medical necessity. It's Mr. Holm, is it? Listening to his testimony and looking at the fact that he looks like he has some really good functioning prosthetics here, I would have much more of a tendency to believe Mr. Holm's doctor deciding what's medically necessary as opposed to a bureaucrat sitting behind a phone somewhere working for someone else's interest deciding what's medically necessary when they have not seen the patient, they don't know the patient, and they're probably not a medical professional. And even if they are a medical professional, I know there's some nurses and medical professionals hired by insurance companies simply to deny claims. And I would certainly expect the doctor who's treating the patient to know what's medically necessary.
Mr. Barsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And quickly in response to that, Senator Erickson-Robes, our medical directors who review these decisions are physicians. Many of them are practicing physicians, so they do work with patients, at least for a limited period of time. I can't speak to other insurance companies. We don't hire people to deny claims. When it comes to the coverage of prosthetics and orthotics, which is a coverage policy we have, we do cover prosthetics and orthotics, including some of the new technologies, including the ones that Mr. Holm has. So, you know, I take exception to that idea that we're basically hiring people to deny claims. We're not. We're covering these devices, and in many cases, we're covering the new devices when they can show a benefit to the patient. Again, my concern is when we're talking about medical necessity, that's a term used in your coverage policy. Okay, and as was testified earlier, there's guidelines used by both the provider and the insurer to determine if we're meeting those guidelines. And this bill would remove our ability to use those guidelines. That's our concern in terms of what this will mean in terms of utilization and overall cost.
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Additional mandates, no matter how well-intended, increase the cost of insurance. And our interest in this is that Minnesota already has 64 mandates. And even if it only increases 1% every single time you add another mandate, that's 64% already increase, and we just continue to add on to that. At some point, it's going to be a fully mandated insurance market, and we need to start looking at these numbers and what we're doing to the cost of insurance by continuously adding mandates. Adding more mandates simply make health insurance more expensive. Premiums increase when the cost of medical services go up, and unless steps are taken to address the underlying costs of the medical care, healthcare costs will continue to grow at an unsustainable rate, making it even more difficult for families and small businesses to maintain the health care coverage. Because as the system is currently set up, these mandates only apply to the fully insured market, which is 27% of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
If I may.
One more comment, Ms. Cuffell.
Madam Chair, I have a comment.
We have on our fact sheet, we talk about saving dollars makes sense. And if these individuals who need prosthetic devices and orthotic devices are not granted the appropriate devices that they need, they become more sedentary. That leads to all different types of comorbidities and different issues that are more costly to the insurance carriers themselves. Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just thinking about something we've been seeing in the paper last few weeks about other states where their rates have been going up anywhere from 40% to 60%, many of them that have much less mandates on them than Minnesota. In fact, what I hear is by the system that we have, we were able to, even with the mandates, even though we're heavily regulated, we tend to keep our increases much more in line than many other states. So I'm not sure if that there's a correlation, direct correlation, that if there's a mandate, that it automatically means that our rates are going to go out, you know, through the roof. I mean, it certainly has some correlation that may increase it, but compared to some of these other states where they're having these ridiculous increases in rates, I think we're doing pretty good.
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I'm sorry I don't haven't met you yet, but the one thing, I know California has been in the news a lot about their increases that are completely out of control, but they also have a group that actually does a fiscal analysis of every mandate before they add it, and I would highly recommend, you know, taking on something like that where you actually know the fiscal impact before you pass additional mandates, and perhaps something like that is happening in more than just that state that I'm unaware of, but something like that, you know, would be recommended just so we know how it actually is impacting each additional time.
Mr. Hickey.
Madam Chair, thanks. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I just wanted to make a couple of brief comments. I've spoke many times with you about mandates and their effect on small business. NFIB, with about 12,000 members, is the most affected constituency of these mandates. Virtually none of our members are self-insured. They're struggling to provide health insurance. Everybody's well aware of that. But what's really concerning is we're just seeing an A through Z of mandates being proposed in this two-year biannual session of the legislature. I believe this is about the eighth one. Now, while this is a very compelling mandate, we still struggle with cost. It's more compelling than other ones we've seen, but it doesn't change the fact that there's a lot of unknowns about the cost, and the small business owners in your communities are struggling with premiums and trying to provide health insurance, and some of them don't, but they don't need the state doing anything to raise the cost of their health care, and there's a big question mark over this bill, especially based on some of the good comments Mr. Barsh made. I also want to just raise the question, how many of the advocates know if they would benefit from this bill? We know about 27% of the total insurance market, maybe about 40% or less now of the private market will benefit from this. The advocates even know if they'll benefit from this. We've seen people testify before on other mandates that wouldn't even benefit from it, but it's just a question the advocates need to ask themselves. Would I be part of the minority that would benefit from this bill, or am I part of the vast majority that will not benefit from this bill due to our lopsided market structure, which only gets worse every year? Finally, on that topic, we are just creating a new inequity here. We have the ERISA preemption and all the current concern it's causing for NFIB and other groups you've heard from today, but we're also getting this inequity with medical assistance in the MA program. And all these mandates should apply to our public health care programs. And one was made to apply last year that hasn't passed. But that's another equity question. If this is going to be put on the backs of small businesses and some individuals, shouldn't we have it in our public programs too? And I'd urge somebody to bring up that amendment. That's a real equity issue that matters to us. I think you're going to have a significant population that would benefit from these mandates in that pool of people also. So thanks for the time.
Questions? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 2139 as amended. Do you recommend it to pass?
And it goes to finance?
Fine. There was a fiscal note request because we think it's going to save money, but I don't know that we had one.
Is it going to finance? We have a goes to the floor?
Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, does something like this typically go to Commerce?
It has been to Commerce.
Okay. It came out of Commerce.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I will make a comment on the whole subject of the mandates. I think we're going to be seeing next year we may see twice as many mandate bills in 5 years from now. We didn't need a mandate for this years ago because it used to be covered. I think what we're having is a deterioration of our health care system, and they're cutting back a little more here, and then we come in and, last year we had one where women who had C-sections were being turned down for coverage as a pre-existing condition. I just think that it suggests the bigger need to fix the healthcare system, but bottom line is, Ms. Kufo wasn't here several years ago because they were having, when the doctors made the medical determination, they were covered, and now they're not anymore, and we're needing the mandates because it's things that have been covered in the past, and well, we're not going to do that. And I think if we're going to say health care means fewer and fewer things, and then we just ignore more and more, our problems can get worse faster. So anyway, I will move the bill, and I'll suggest, because I there has been no fiscal note, we don't think there's any cost to state. If anything, it should be savings, but I don't know that we've heard anything from the Department of Finance on that. So I'll move it to the floor unless Senator Berglund wants it to go that way.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I believe all these things are already covered by the Medicaid program. They're not.
Mr. Barsh.
Excuse me, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund. I believe prosthetics and orthotics are covered in medical assistance, just as they are in the private market. But I think the language that allows for the growth in the coverage of them would potentially have a cost to the state through our state, if it applied to them, which it doesn't. Or to our state employee group insurance plan.
Well, that I was going to say next, that it might have a fiscal note from CGIP, and that wouldn't be in my division. So I think you'd rather have it go there than not, than to have it pulled off the floor, probably.
Senator Marty.
If it's going to have a problem like that.
Madam Chair, I'll leave it up to you. You're the chair who would be requesting it, so I'll let you make the call.
No, I don't have CGIP in my division.
It would be
Betzel.
Senator
Betzel.
Oh, Betzel. I'm told
Senator Marty.
That the Medicare guidelines are the ones that Medicaid has been following, so this shouldn't have any change there, but Senator Betzel has not requested or has requested it. I'm going to assume not. I'll send it to the floor, and if he calls it in, that's fine.
Okay. Senator Marty renews his motion that Senate File 2139 is amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Senator Marty, you have another bill here.
Senate File 3099, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Senate File 3099 would attempt to reduce our human exposure to arsenic and would do so in terms of prohibiting poultry, chicken, poultry and pigs from being fed feed that has supplements that contains roxarsone, which is a arsenic additive, which is being done apparently for a variety of things to stimulate growth in the poultry, and also because it apparently helps the food look more attractive, makes the meat appear pinker, and so on. But I have Dr. David Walenga from the Institute for Ag and Trade Policy here to speak to it. I did not realize until a constituent several years ago, a chemical engineer, told me that this was the case, and he was very concerned about it. And then I remember seeing some billboards in the Twin Cities saying, our chickens don't contain any arsenic. We don't feed our chickens arsenic or something of that sort. And I had not been aware of this until that time, but this bill would simply prohibit it from being people from adding feed that contains arsenic to the poultry or pigs. And with that, I'd like to either answer questions or turn it over to Dr. Walenga.
Dr. Walenga.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. Just want to spend a few minutes talking about the public health issue, which, as Senator Marty indicated, is our cumulative exposure to arsenic, which is a quite serious toxin, one that we know the most about in the environment. Arsenic, as you probably know, is a known carcinogen, means causes cancer in people, not just one cancer, but multiple cancers, lung, skin, liver, bladder, kidney, colon. And it can do that even at the low levels at which it occurs in the environment. Now, some of those environmental levels are from arsenic sort of percolating up out of the Earth's crust. They're naturally occurring. Other reasons, though, why that arsenic is in the environment is from intentional human uses. Minnesotans, many of them, are drinking arsenic-contaminated drinking water. And even at the legal limit that was set by the EPA of 10 parts per billion, if one were to drink that level of arsenic-contaminated water on a daily basis, that would add to your lifetime cancer risk such that you would have about a 1 in 300 chance of developing cancer just from that arsenic exposure. So that's disregarding your tobacco use or your exposure to other kinds of carcinogens. So it's a pretty important, serious thing. There are other non-cancer effects of arsenic, though, that are also quite serious. We have an epidemic of diabetes. Arsenic can contribute or cause diabetes as well as heart disease. And among little people, fetuses and infants, the exposure to arsenic is even more concerning because they're more vulnerable to its effects. So, for instance, the leading science or the cutting-edge science indicates a link between arsenic exposure in drinking water and diminished brain function and development in children. And then finally, some newer science is that arsenic can disrupt hormone function, various forms of arsenic. And all this is from the National Academy of Sciences or other peer-reviewed medical journals. So one issue that's often brought up is the fact that the arsenic that's put into animal feed is what's called an organic form of arsenic. And in years past, it was thought that this was less toxic in its form than what's called inorganic arsenic, the kind that's most often found in drinking water. But, you know, looking at the science, I don't think we can make that assumption anymore for a couple of different reasons. First of all, there are studies that show that arsenic in the liver will build up regardless of whether it's an organic or inorganic form. The other thing is that bacteria, like the ones that live in the soil, or the ones that live in our gut or in an animal's gut can actually convert between different forms of arsenic. So even though the arsenic going into the animal's mouth might be organic arsenic, that bacteria can convert that arsenic into inorganic arsenic, which is the cancer-causing one. So where is it in the animal environment? Well, it's a feed additive, along with some other things, some other metals, some other antibiotics, which I know is another issue Senator Marty's looking at. And it's approved. There are about 105 products now approved containing arsenic in animal feed. The mass majority are a particular form of arsenic called roxarsone, and here's the label for roxarsone that you would see on a feed additive bag. If you just look at roxarsone, there's three FDA-approved uses to promote growth, to have the birds grow faster on less feed efficiency, and to pigment the meat. Now, the growers who are using arsenicals will often also say that they're using it for control of a parasite, but the products that are typically sold combine the arsenic ingredient with other ingredients like antibiotics, so it's a little unclear which of those ingredients is actually controlling the parasites. So some of the problems from my perspective with this practice is that it's not a prescription practice. Okay, you don't need a prescription to do this. There are many places in the world where it's not approved or hasn't been approved as safe. And it also raises some concerns about resistance, that is bacterial resistance, that I won't go into here. So as I said, there's different kinds of arsenic compounds that are approved, mainly in chickens and turkeys, one approved use in swine as well. Some of the difficulties in assessing the concerns around poultry use in the U.S. is that we don't actually track the use. So what we have are estimates of use. But if you look at estimates from various sources, they generally indicate, at least as of 2002, that about 70% of the 8.5 billion broiler chickens produced in the U.S. are given arsenic through much of their lifespan. And whether you're using industry data or data or estimates from other sources, that amounts to a lot of arsenic in chicken feed and therefore in the chicken litter too, in the manure too. So I mentioned this. One problem is that the feed additives are actually combinations of different things, so arsenic plus antibiotics plus another group of chemicals called anaphores. The FDA doesn't really look at these things together when they approve the product. They just look at them singly. So anyway, one important factor from a public health standpoint is what happens to all the manure that's created that has arsenic in it. And the estimate nationwide is that this amounts to about 26 to 55 billion pounds of poultry litter a year, that's much of which is probably arsenic contaminated. Most of this is then put back on the land as fertilizer. So there have been concerns raised about the impact of that then on groundwater. And there are some studies showing that it may contribute to groundwater contamination with arsenic. I'll just talk briefly about some of the other public health concerns. Minnesota is the only state that's approved an incinerator specifically to burn poultry litter with arsenic in it. And so this could put that arsenic in the feed back into the air and disseminate it. There's some concerns around that. And research that the USDA researchers have done in addition to my organization shows that about 55% of the limited samples of meat purchased at grocery stores contain arsenic residues. So in short, I'm going to skip to the punchline here. In short, arsenic's a really serious toxin and heavy metal. That shouldn't be too much of a surprise. We're exposed to it via various routes. This intentional use in poultry feed is just an addition to all the other ways that we're exposed to arsenic, and it's a voluntary and, from my standpoint, unnecessary use. And that's why I'm here talking about this issue in the context of the bill before you. Thank you.
Dr. Wallingo, why did they use arsenic?
Well, the FDA has three labeled uses for which it has approval: to pigment the meat, to promote the growth of the birds more quickly, and to promote that growth using less feed. So none of those are a specific health use. As I said, the companies that, or the growers that use the feed additive also think, in some cases, that it controls a certain parasite infection called coccidiosis. But growers in other countries are able to control that without the arsenic.
And the other things, pigmenting the meat and the growth and everything, is that something that could be provided using other substances or just green?
Well, there are cosmetic reasons or economic reasons. They're not health-based reasons. So one could either not do it, I suppose, in terms of pigmenting the meat, or in terms of growth promotion, there's certainly other things that growers use for growth promotion. And there's many growers, including all the certified organic growers in the U.S., including probably Tyson's Chicken, that don't use arsenic at all.
Okay. Questions? Senator Hahn.
thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Wallingo. Help me understand this. Is it your testimony that the FDA is approving something that is harmful to people and they just aren't concerned about that? Or, I mean, basically, what I'm getting from your testimony is that these things have been looked at and have been used for longer than I've been alive in chickens, and the FDA is saying this is fine, it's not a harmful level for human beings, and you're saying no, they're wrong. So why would the FDA continue to say that's permissible?
Well, you know, I think some of these approvals, the first arsenic in chicken feed was approved in 1946. So science progresses. Sometimes it moves quite fast. FDA science, maybe not so fast. So I think we're at a point where there's a lot more information now about these practices and some of the public health concerns, and perhaps our regulatory setup hasn't quite caught up to the science.
And Madam Chair and Dr. Wallingo, thank you. So just to be clear, your testimony is that we should trust your testimony and not the FDA for our judgment on this. I think that's what you're saying.
No, well, I would say that...
Dr. Wallingo.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm giving my perspective on the science as somebody who's actually looked at it for quite closely for 6 years.
Okay.
And I can give you all the scientific references, including the National Academy of Sciences. There's a USDA scientist named Tamara Lasky. She now works at the National Institutes of Health. And my work on this actually evolved out of a study that she published using internal data showing that this was a concern from her perspective. So I can't attest to why FDA hasn't moved more quickly on this.
And Madam Chair and Dr. Wallingo, I appreciate it. My point is I am of the belief that the FDA does have a lot of resources and lots of data and lots of scientists and lots of experts. And I guess if the testimony is that we can't trust the FDA, then that's what it is. I'd like, though, to ask you, Doctor, are there cases that you know of in the country or in Minnesota where human beings have been harmed by arsenic consumption from eating chicken or swine? Can you name instances where that has been established?
Dr. Wallingo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Minnesotans, like people nationally, are suffering from epidemic rates of chronic diseases like diabetes,
Senator
Hahn, he is answering your question.
All right. So Americans are suffering from epidemic rates of cancer and other chronic diseases. These things, virtually none of them have a single cause. There are many contributors, and arsenic and heavy metals are one contributor to these epidemic problems. So it's my opinion that this is a good potential way to prevent long-term disease and save on health care costs long-term.
And, Madam Chair, thank you, and I apologize, Doctor, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I don't think you've answered or addressed my question, however, which is, as I understand your answer, that there is no study, no cases that would say that eating chicken or poultry has had an effect on anyone's health with respect to arsenic. There may be your opinion that you could speculate that there are lots of things, and this may be one of them, but there is no causal effect relationship established that I'm aware of or that you're aware of.
Actually, I would, Madam Chair, I would say that it's my opinion that there are causal links between arsenic exposure and all these health problems that I've talked about. Is arsenic the sole cause of those problems? No, that's kind of the wrong question from a scientific standpoint, because they are not conditions for which there are sole causes.
And Madam Chair and Dr. Willinga, my question was specifically about the arsenic found in chickens and pork, which is the substance of this bill. And there may be arsenic-related things, that's true, but my question is, can they be related to what's found in chicken or pork? And I take it you say are saying no.
Senator Hand, he's answered that question. We really need to move on,
well,
because
Chair,
we are going to hear from some people on the other side.
I understand. I just have a couple more questions I'd like to ask for Dr. Willinga. And Madam Chair and Doctor, isn't it true that traces of arsenic are found in other things besides chicken and pork? And I'm looking at some data here that says, for example, that in shrimp, there's something, the data I see says 42,000 parts per billion of arsenic found in shrimp. In haddock, which is a kind of a fish, 2,200 parts per billion. Cornmeal, 800 parts per billion. Drinking water, which you've referred to, may contain as much as 10 parts per billion. So if there is some, and the studies that I'm looking at here say that it might be 20 parts per billion, which is 1/25 the level that's deemed safe by the FDA, which we've already had some discussion about. In fact, that there's arsenic in newspapers, that if we read a newspaper, we may have. And so my question is, given that there's arsenic in these various places that we're exposed to, and the fact that arsenic is a naturally occurring element that, unless there's a way to ban it from the universe, I don't think we'll always have it with us. What I'm trying to get at is, where is the harm, the direct harm, that would require us to ban this product for poultry and swine? And there doesn't seem to be, in your testimony, any specific evidence that says that should be done. I understand you have a belief that there's a connection between arsenic generally, but since there is arsenic found virtually everywhere, why is it that this should be done and not banning newspapers or banning drinking water?
Senator Marty.
Can I respond to that quickly? Senator Hand, I think as Dr. Willinga said, we're trying to reduce exposure to it, and it is in multiple places. It may occur in chicken naturally in tiny amounts, and adding to it is not a healthy thing. And I got to say that one of his slides talked about other sources of arsenic, and they mentioned where it's been added and so on. Arsenic-treated wood playground equipment. About 10, 15 years ago, I tried to put in a bill to ban that, and we had the industry. I had people fly in from all over the country to tell me why that was a terrible idea, totally harmless, totally no problem. A year later, EPA signed a consent agreement with the industry to ban it forever. The industry was saying it's absolutely safe, no problems whatsoever, and then they ban it. And it was a voluntary agreement. It was not banned. They just agreed to voluntarily never produce it anymore. And the industry, again, the EPA was saying was absolutely, they had approved it. The EPA had approved it for time and time again, and it just takes time. And the FDA may, 20 years from now, after all the harm is done for 20 more years, they may step in and do it. We're trying to speed it up. European Union catches on to some of these things before our regulatory system does.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Marty, and I appreciate
Senator
that.
Hand.
And it could be that they've done this because of the fact that once we alarm the population over things that are really not dangerous and say they really are dangerous, it creates a climate where companies get fearful of lawsuits and other things, and so it may be in their financial interest to do these things. But I think that, to me, is part of the problem that we're facing here. What we're doing, I think, causes more harm than good, because we teach the public that they should be afraid to eat chicken when they shouldn't be, or they should be afraid to eat pork when they shouldn't be. And I think that just because we can detect things, or that the FDA, we can't trust the FDA. And I think this does great harm. And so I think that your bill is very harmful, and we shouldn't pass the bill. But that's my opinion.
I understand.
Okay, I'd like to call now on Bob Zelenka and Greg Engelke. Mr. Zelenka?
No, this is Greg. I'll have Greg go first.
Okay. Mr. Engelke?
Engelke. Madam Chairman and Senators, thank you. My name's Greg Engelke. I'm a practicing poultry nutritionist. I run my own consulting company here in Minnesota called Cornerstone Resources. I've been a poultry nutritionist for not quite 30 years. For 20 years of that time period, I worked for two major international companies and U.S. companies. So I've looked at chickens from Minnesota to Arkansas to Poland to Switzerland to Latin America. I really get my kicks out of chickens and amino acids and phosphorus side of things. When I became aware of this bill, I had some initial concerns on it because I've used these products. I currently use some of these products in the industry in specific situations. And I think it's important that we understand some background because there's a lots of use of data that may be questionable out there. First and foremost, we must remember that arsenic is a natural occurring element that's been talked about. And like many of these elements, there are different things that can happen depending upon whether you're using a little bit or a lot of things. And when we talk about a little bit, that's what we're talking about in the case of the use of arsenic in certain products, in certain specific feeds, for certain amounts of times with it. We're talking about the use of grams of a product, small, minute grams of products, into tons of feed. So, like many things in life, a little is fine, a lot can be a lot worse. It's obviously naturally forming out there. It's in the periodic tables, just like gold and carbon are, or nitrogen. As previously was talked about, the fact it's also found in different plants and other animals, particularly marine animals, tend to have higher levels, and that will vary depending upon tissue levels with it. But in many cases, at 1,000 to 2,000 times the amount of what you may find in a chicken breast with it. Roxazone is a FDA-approved animal medication. Many people try to misrepresent it also and call it an antibiotic. Roxazone itself is not an antibiotic. It is a chemical compound. It is part of the normal feed medication that the FDA manages and monitors out there. It's been used widely in our production systems. There's well-established procedures at the FDA to ensure our safety and the efficacy of products such as Roxazone. The FDA takes seriously how they set residue levels that are determined under very scientific conditions, and with scientific conditions, that means replication. That means control of environments, control of controls. And these are used to determine what levels would be safe for the human and also for the animal. I would suggest that the FDA has a scientific depth of understanding and a means of staff and resources to initially and in an ongoing manner to monitor and to ascertain the results in a scientific means to truly understand the mode of action and the outcome of results. At the same time, I would suggest that individual states do not have that talent pool or the resources to conduct such a robust procedures and protocols that animal products must go through at the FDA level. I would also suggest for those of you that are not familiar with how products are cleared through the FDA, the hurdles that animal products must get for clearance are actually much more, I would suggest, are, and many scientists would suggest, are much more stringent than those for human product clearances with it. And that's very fine. That's the reason why literally millions of dollars are used to conduct trials to look at the efficacy and to understand the mode of action of how a compound or a product will act. And that is understanding it both as an individual compound or in combination with other compounds with it. I would suggest that with new clearances that the FDA does, where they, and most of these new clearances have been for combination clearances, they do look at the data individually, but they also have to have collective data relative to responses and the mode of action differences between them. Poultry are highly susceptible to internal pesticides, and their pesticides are coccidia, protozoans. They live within the intestine, and that those naturally occur out there in the environment in very clean housing and more so in dirty housing conditions. These parasites cause diseases which trigger intestinal irritations, diarrhea, dehydration, and ultimately mortality or morbidity within flocks. Roxazone as a compound with the small, minute amount of arsenic that is present is a highly effective feed additive for controlling coccidiosis, the disease coccidiosis. It also helps in controlling salmonella, particularly in young birds, which is important relative to ultimately the seeding of the environment with salmonella prior for birds going to processing, so we can actually decrease the level of exposure. So what are we really doing? We're managing the gut intestinal system of that bird much better through these compounds. Roxazole is used to improve food safety. Once again, why? Because we're controlling diseases, we're controlling exposure to salmonella. And that is good both from the bird standpoint, and I would also suggest from the human standpoint with it. We improve the health of the general health of the bird, the overall animal welfare, through by having a more healthy gut. This more healthy gut, I might suggest, is also the reason for the improvement in pigmentation. And it is not, as has previously been suggested, relative to coloration of the meat. There is no change in the coloration of the meat. The pigmentation is relative to the absorption ability of the gut to absorb naturally occurring pigments called xanthophylls, which are in corn. And what do you get with that? You get a yellow-skinned type of bird. It's by having a good gut health, the higher absorption you can have with that. Roxazome helps to do that along the way. I would also suggest that it enhances the environment and sustainability. You might ask why. Well, it's very simply because of the fact we are able to improve our feed conversions, less pounds of feed, better improvement of nutrients from plants and animals into meat production for human consumption. Environmentally, Roxazone is an organic form of arsenic. I would suggest that the data would show that there is a difference there, and the reason for that difference has to do with bonding potential relative to how tightly these compounds are held versus going into solution over time period with it. The FDA stated in 2006 at present they were not aware of any substantial impacts from this use, and they're closely following research of arsenic risk analysis developments. FDA has no data to suggest that there have been any adverse effect on human health due to the use of these new animal feed medications. And the reason why we say new, even though it's an old product, is the fact that, once again, it's an ongoing basis with it, and particularly as new combinations of medications are approved through the FDA. The poultry industry needs to maintain.
I'm going to interrupt for just a second. I think we're running over our committee time, and we still have another testifier. I think probably at this point, Senator Marty may be laying this bill on the table to continue discussion this evening. I've been told that this room needs to be vacated for another committee. Is that correct? Oh, we don't know that for sure. Okay. But
why don't we just go another 3 or 4 minutes. If they're going to have more testimony, we should continue tonight. That's fine with me.
Okay. Because we do need to wrap up the committee.
I can be brief, Madam Chair.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's very frank. I would just simply end by saying the fact that it is an important tool in our tool chest to be able to manage disease through a rotational basis of medications.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Zelenka.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent the grain elevator and feed mill industry here in the state of Minnesota. We employ over 9,000 people in the state. We're in over 600 communities around the state. The average feed mill handles about 36,000 tons of feed per year, and we handle over $5 million in annual sales annually as well. Long story short, I played the role of Mortimer in my high school play of Arsenic and Old Lace, and that was inorganic arsenic that was utilized in that play. What we're talking about here today is organic substance. Our grain elevators and feed mills use the product because our customers want the product. It's a feed additive. It's a non-antibiotic feed additive. It reduces the need for antibiotics, reduces the salmonella in broilers, coccidiosis, which was mentioned earlier, the parasites, by reducing that actually reduces the need for antibiotics by the way it works. The thing that I guess bothers me in the bill, among other things, is the limit on the sale of the product. We do business in multiple states. That would certainly make it difficult for us to do business in Minnesota to meet the needs of our members. We're aware of no violations of the use of this product. We are inspected by USDA on a random basis on samples that are taken. And again, we're not aware of any violations being occurring. So long story short, I'll just again be brief. It helps to keep the flocks healthier. Our customers expect that. It helps in weight gain and so forth. So without any further, I guess we have concerns about the bill, and we would certainly be concerned about the loss of this product or that tool in the toolbox, as everybody seems to refer to. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zelenka. Senator Marty, do you have a recommendation on how you want to do the bill?
I think, what time do we come in again? 6 o'clock?
6:30, right? I believe.
6:30. I think, why don't we lay the bill over until then and just recess committee until, just recess, not adjourn, because we're going to start up at 6 o'clock in room 112.
And we'll vote on the bill, and there's board members at the table.
Okay. Let's take it up then in the evening. Then.
Okay.
We have about 6 other bills, I think, as well.
Okay. So. Okay. With that, we'll make a motion to
recess.
Okay. We'll just recess until this evening then. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is actually super, super organic arsenic.
Inorganic arsenic.
Soil bacteria can burn. So they take it to manure.
Just an FYI, this is recycling, but then the stuff that I set up here, the bills will deal with tonight. I sorted my stuff.
The rest of them are messy.
I know.
Yeah, you'll be okay. You'll be here tonight.
Yeah. See you later. Yes, and then we're back here at 6 upstairs in 112.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
I can do that. Cool.
Okay.
days at the afternoon.
She said the audio was still working.
Okay.